Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferrant, and tonight's topic is John Singleton, the writer-director known for Boys in the Hood and many others, including television series such as Snowfall and episodes of OJ. Excuse me. Carl Kafer is our pinch-hitting guest in for Perry Seibert, who could not be with us this week. Say hello, Carl.
Hello, it's a punt, and I got the first. How's that?
Yep. And as usual, Aaron White is joining us. So, Aaron, say hello.
Hello.
Yep. So, you know, Singleton, like I said, he's probably best known for Boys in the Hood, but he's done a lot of work. I mean, he was around from 91 till 2018. He did films like Baby Boy, Higher Learning, Rosewood. But there's just so much to his films and to his work. It's not so much the volume as the quality for me with this guy. But I want to ask the question I always ask here, and that is, how did we first come to the work of John Singleton? And I'll start with you, Aaron. So how did we first come to him?
Oh, man. I honestly don't remember the first thing I saw by him. Boys is one of those things I came too late but knew about for years before I actually got to see it.
That definitely happened.
And I know I hadn't seen much. Same with Poetic Justice. Like, if you're of a certain age, you were very aware of the things that Tupac was doing. Poetic Justice was one that I always knew about, but hadn't seen until actually very recently. And then I know for sure that I had seen something he had done before I saw The People versus O.J. Simpson, because I took note that he had directed the episode in that miniseries. I just cannot remember for the life of me what it was. I may have seen Boys by then. Like I said, I came to that one pretty late. And maybe Shaft, too. His remake of Shaft.
That's a fun.
It really is. I think it's a little underrated.
Yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, I'm gonna say that for me, I came to him like so many did. I came to him with Boys in the Hood. Now, I did not see Boys in the Hood when it was very first out. I didn't get to see it until a few years later. You know, I knew that he'd done a few other movies by then, but I saw Boys in the Hood, I'm going to say maybe around 95, 96. It took about 4 or 5 years for me to get around to being able to see it. And I'm not sure at the age of 10 that I would have liked it or enjoyed it as much as when I did see it when I was a teenager. I'm going to say that my first Singleton film that I saw in the theater, I did see Rosewood, and I did see Baby Boy. But other than that, I didn't see any other Singletons in the theater. So that's my story. So what about you, Carl? How did you come to Singleton?
Well, being the old guy with the walker, you couldn't get past any news, entertainment news in 91 when Boys in the Hood came out. And then, of course, you know, he's the youngest he's the youngest person ever to win Best Director, and he's the first black director to win best picture. Yeah. And now I was in Bradford at the time, which was they weren't going to run Boys in the Hood in the theater in Bradford. not going to happen. So I had to wait until it came on to HBO, or it might have been the Movie Channel. I'm not sure which. But I saw it. I was impressed. And really the person that really got me in that was Lawrence Fishburne. Because
he's
just
amazing.
Like, I saw him in that movie and like, that man is going to be a star. He's phenomenal. And so I was really impressed with that one. But that's how I came to know John Singleton, was Boys in the Hood.
Yeah, no. We could do a whole show on Boys in the Hood. It's such an impressive film on so many levels. You know, the cast, the work Singleton did as a writer and a director, and that really does bring me to my next question, and that is, do we think that he was better as a writer or as a director, Carl, and why?
I'm going to say something so that's going to pick you off. How about a producer? Okay, he produced Hustle and Flow and then Black Snake Moan. And actually, Rachel and I just did a commentary watching on Black Snake Moan. And his work with Craig Brewer, I think, is phenomenal. As far as a writer or director, I would say probably a director a little more than a writer, though they're both very, very close because he did write most of his own material. But really, I think as a producer, too, because he produced that TV series that went really well, too, which I've not seen, but I've heard that it's really good. Which one is that? You mentioned it.
Snowfall and Billions were the two shows that worked on well. He also did episodes of the O.J. Portion of American Crime Story.
Well, I'm talking as a producer. Okay, I'm talking as a producer, and as a producer, he was executive producer of Snowfall for 61 episodes. So that I thought he did really well. And then, as I mentioned, Black Snake Moan and Hustle and Flow, and he produced all his films, too. Let's not forget that, from Poetic Justice on. So, you know, I mean, as a producer, I think he did really well. So that's what I would say.
And, Aaron, what about you? What is your feeling on him as a director?
He was a better director. When his films don't quite get up to snuff, it's not because he's making poor decisions. It's because grip's not all the way there. He is a masterful director. He's a very good writer. He wrote Boys in the Hood, and that alone proves his writing talent. He wrote Baby Boy. He wrote all of his own films. Well, until the end. I don't think he wrote the last couple.
No, he didn't write those last three.
But
or Rosewood, supposedly. I think he came
Rosewood,
up with the script,
that's right. Yeah, he developed it, though, as the director. But that's, for me, like, yes, he's very much a writer-director. But when his films do suffer at points, it's because there was an issue in the script, not the way he shot it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he was a fantastic director and a very good writer. You know, I think that he gets compared a lot to Spike Lee. And one of the key differences for me is that Spike is as great a director as he is a writer, whereas Singleton, while a very, very good director, had the ability to be a great director, but his scripts weren't always on the same level as his direction.
Right.
His and his work on television, you know, where he, you know, I think really does prove that he was a better director than a writer. I mean, especially look at that O.J. episode that he did. That could be the best episode of the whole damn show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because of what he put in there in terms of, I'm not talking necessarily visual flair. I'm not talking about, you know, odd visuals like you'd find in a Buñuel or a Wes Anderson film, but just the way he handles the entire approach to shooting a film or an episode, or I should say did. So, Carl, moving on. Not Carl, but Aaron. What are his themes here? We'll go to themes next. What themes do you think are most present in his work?
Yeah, I'm going to stick with the ones that he wrote, plus Rosewood, I guess. The first seven films. He is very much writing films, A, about the black experience, B, about structural injustice in America and how the system fails and how what can look from the outside like failure of the community is truly failure of America to support a large minority population. And for now, Rosewood puts a really fine point on that going back centuries now. And so each film, Boys is about gentrification and the way that cities crumble. But once they start pumping money into these dilapidated areas, the people who live there get pushed out. And he's talking about this decades before anyone else.
I think
Baby
it's something
Boy
that he really knew.
Yeah. Baby Boy is about the infantilization of black men and how that is the system's fault, but also that black men maybe need to fight harder to break that cycle. And so he's pushing against the system, but he's also pushing against the community and saying, yes, we're being beaten down, but we can do better too. And so it's really fine, like tightrope he's walking, especially considering that his films are true. Like these are mainstream films. These aren't art house films, because that's another big difference between him and Spike. Spike makes art house films. Singleton made mainstream films and he had a lot to say in them.
Yeah, and you know it's that is an interesting point, and I want to circle back to that in just a second. But you know what I said about your point on his understanding of gentrification, you know, that's something he saw. He saw the effects of that in L.A. He saw the effects of societal decay where he grew up in Los Angeles, and that obviously made a huge impact on how he was going to present the ideas in his films. But I think we'll get back to that in a second. I want to ask Carl his question, or his part of this question, next. So, Carl, what about your view on themes in his films?
Well, I think Aaron got it pretty well set. The one difference I find between him and Spike Lee is that he seems to be more personal, and it's not the character overcoming the odds, but it's very, very much about the black community. It's also about the dirtiest word in the English language, which is gentrification. And the effects of that and the political and social pressures on a community, and particularly usually focused on a specific person who's weighing all this around. And I think he's very good at that. You know, and it's not just the Boys in Hood. I mean, he has that in Poetic Justice and various other films, Higher Learning, too. And he does that on a campus, which is very interesting. What's the name of Spike Lee's film?
Cool Days.
Cool Days.
Yeah. And I find that a better movie than School Days, easily.
Oh, I think it's a better movie than School Days, by far.
Mm-hmm. And I think he's really thinking about it. He's being even-handed, which is, you know, and you mentioned that too, Aaron, in terms of, you know, that there's fault on both sides. Which I think is a very brave thing to come across when you're aiming your film specifically at a black audience.
Yeah, he's very much taking too. Everybody in that cinema to school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to say something before we get on to the Spike topic just here for a second. When my father saw Boys in the Hood, because I saw it, and then I was like, hey, you got to see this movie. And he was like, yeah, but isn't that movie really hateful? I was like, no, absolutely not. And he saw it, and he was like, wow, that's a really empathetic, and that's like a plea for peace, and God, wow. I mean, he was stunned by it. And I said, yeah, well, you know, you've been avoiding Do the Right Thing, too, and you need to get your ass to see that. but, of course, you know, I was the 11-year-old kid that dragged his father to go see Malcolm X. So I was probably the only 11-year-old white boy that went to see Malcolm X.
I'm sure you were. Okay.
In the theater, so I don't know.
You're probably the only 11-year-old. Period, who saw the 3-hour, 20-minute runtime and said, yeah, I'm in.
Hey, you know, honestly, having already read the autobiography of Malcolm X at that point, I was like, yeah, that seems like a fair enough runtime. But, you know, I mean, I think the weekend before that opened, I'd finally seen Lawrence of Arabia. I think I was 11 when I first saw that one. So, and you know, the Godfather trilogy was already my favorite movie of all time. So, and I was an unusual kid.
What you're telling us is you were already weird at 11. I'm very proud of you. I just want you to know that.
I wasn't weird. I was highly unusual. There's a
no, you were weird. Okay, embrace it. Trust me.
No, Weird was my cat at the time. No, that motherfucker, I loved her, but Jesus Christ, she was weird. I swear she could talk. Meow? Do you want to go out? No. What what the fuck? Did she just say no?
Yeah. What?
Yep.
But, yeah, no, Spike's interesting, you know. Spike has been more of an independent filmmaker in the way that so many African-American filmmakers have had to be. Singleton is unusual in that he got the backing of major studios, and he got to do films that, you know, you look at him now and you go, oh, well, surely these were independent. What the fuck? He had this studio and that studio? I mean, he did Rosewood. You mean Boys in the Hood was a major studio release? Yeah, guys. You know, there was a period back in the late 80s through the late 90s where, you know, major studios were still backing films like this.
Well,
that's
a moment. In the 90s, there was a real push for black themed films. It was like a mini revival of you know, so that decade really was ripe for that. And studios.
Well, let's not forget that, you know, there's you know, people talk about Singleton and Spike Lee, but, you know, Charles Burnett did maybe his best film. I think it was 1990, 91. You had Cosy Lemon with Eve's Bayou. And there are so many other movies. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a very strong decade for African-American filmmakers.
Yeah, absolutely. Just wanted to make that point.
And I will also say that we had some very fine directors coming onto the scene or starting to really make their mark on television. People like, well, Clark Johnson, who played Meldrick Lewis on Homicide, he started directing episodes of television during the 90s on Homicide. You had Paris Barclay, who won a couple of Emmys for NYPD Blue, you know, a former president of the Directors Guild of America. So, or at least the TV branch. The 90s, that's an interesting period. And Singleton, you know, Singleton was, there's a thing when I think of John Singleton's work and I think of the 90s, they're very linked. And I really have to go back to Boys in the Hood, because Boys in the Hood, it's both an eternal story, and yet it is very much that moment. It's that period from, say, 89 to 91, 92, and you watch it, and if you were around then, even if you didn't live those exact experiences, you know just how real that was.
Mm-hmm.
But, excuse me, I'm having a little bit of coughing here. Sorry about that, folks. So my next question, and it's going to go to you, Carl, and that is, what influences did he have in his films, you know, for his films? When you watch his films, do you see things that maybe he was inspired by or drawn from that remind you of other works? Not necessarily other films, but anything, like, you know, obviously it could be literature, it could be television, it could be theater, it could be artistic movements, philosophical movements.
So I was reading up on him, on John Singleton, and he noted that Star Wars was a big influence on him. And I think in terms of that, it's his love of cinema, you know, what cinema can do. But to be honest, where I see his influences, I see his influences from the great black directors of the 70s, Gordon Parks and Gordon Parks Jr. Van Peebles. Mm-hmm. Norman Van Peebles.
Sure.
You know, and
well, let's not forget he produced Bad Act. Singleton produced the film about the making of Sweet Sweetback.
Right. And let's not forget also that where a lot of those directors in the 70s were a little more exploitative. Singleton and particularly the group in the 90s, Carl Franklin and various others, were more meditative in looking at, you know, the community, the black community, and the problems it had, and so on and so forth. So, you know, there are certain influences from the 70s, but I also think where he came of age and with Boys in the Hood, they were more intuitive of what the problems were. And I mentioned again previously, you know, he was pointing the finger at both sides. He was saying we both have to come together. We have to solve this problem, and we have to realize we're both wrong. And I think, and I can't think of a 70s film really, well, maybe one or two, but where it had that sort of feel to it. But there's no question that his influences came from the black directors of the 70s. As far as I'm concerned, that's where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. And Aaron, what about you?
Definitely agree with Gordon Parks and that Charles Burnett and that group. Hip-hop, I think, cannot, its influence on his films cannot be understated, which at that point was still very new. Here we are celebrating its 50th anniversary now, and this was 35 years ago. So do the math. But I'm going to – Italian neorealism. Mix neorealism with hip-hop, and what do you get? You get Boys in the Hood.
You know, I'm gonna say I wonder what Ice Cube, you know, being he was right there at the center of the birth of hip hop, and he was a singleton guy. I wonder what he would say about that. That'd be interesting to get his opinion on it, because I hadn't thought of it, but now that you say it, yeah, I can see it. I can see it.
Oh yeah, so can I. So can I.
Yeah, that's something to chew on. Huh, we might have to circle back to that, too. So now, Aaron, you get this question, the flip of it. What influences did his films have on the works of others? You know, what is what's come from his movies since?
Well, I can't picture a world that Black Panther exists without John Singleton. Like I said, like, he made mainstream films. And Gordon Parks made mainstream films too, but that was in the 70s. And for, like, in American cinema, you almost have to discount anything in the 70s, because it was such a weird time in Hollywood that we'll never see. Well, hopefully we will see again, but to this point, we've not seen anything that emulates it.
No.
And so here he is. Keep in mind, he made Boys before Rodney King.
Yes.
He made that film about Los Angeles before Rodney King. And again, the Hughes brothers, I would say, are much more John Singleton than they are Spike Lee. They also make really hard but still mainstream films. And you see this diversion in black cinema, I think, that really grows out of Spike and Singleton. where you have the more, and I don't think anyone since Singleton, Ryan Coogler might. I can make an argument for Ryan Coogler, who has really been able to pack these intense social discussions into a mainstream film.
Just look at Fruitvale Station.
Oh yeah, or Creed, or you know, and yeah, it's remarkable. F. Gary Gray, I think, comes out of the John Singleton school.
Probably.
When you see truly mainstream black filmmakers who are still wrestling with these questions, John Singleton's fingerprints are on it. Remarkable film. Dope from 2015. Can't picture that one without it. That one has some spike in it too, but yeah. That's the section of cinema that I think he has his fingerprints on.
For sure. For sure. So you, Carl, what's your feeling here?
Well, I agree with him, okay? No question, I agree with Aaron. But I would also say there was cross-pollination in the 90s. So, you know, you got Spike Lee, you got John Singleton, you got Carl Franklin, you got all these other wonderful directors, you know, Bill Duke, and they all sort of like became this.
I'll throw one out there. Let's not forget Hype Williams and Belly, because that's a damn underrated film.
Yes. But even people like Ernest Dickerson.
Yeah.
You know, and Tales from the Hood, which basically...
Oh, God, I love that movie.
Okay, but that's one of the most brutal takedowns I've ever seen. You know, and so you see all these directors, and I agree with Aaron as far as, you know, going past, but in the 90s, man, I think they cross-pollinated like crazy. I think they all had influences on each other, and that's what I was... You know, that's the point I want to make.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, this kind of brings me to, I was going to ask this question later, but I'll ask it now. Would we then kind of say that his legacy has been that he helped largely with getting that cross-pollination going, and that he also made it to where we see African-American filmmakers in charge of mainstream films? Would that be fair to say that is his legacy? Could we see Black Panther without him? And I'll say this, I have to wonder, you know, I know Coogler has, and it's interesting that you mentioned it, because I know Coogler had talked about having a lot of respect for Singleton. So I wonder, you know, if Singleton hadn't passed when he did, you know, would Marvel maybe have, you know, brought Singleton in on some projects? You know?
Well, I would think that's probable. I don't think that's probable.
I'll be honest, I still wish that we could have gotten the Static Shock project off the ground from the DC was supposed to do in years ago, and it would have been great if Singleton had done that, because I think he'd have been perfect for that material. But the whole Milestone universe is something that I don't know if we'll ever get a proper live adaptation of. But that's just me. That's me going off on a diversion.
Well, you're allowed to do that.
So now I will ask you, Aaron, this question. What is his least impressive movie? What is the movie that you look at and you say, love you, but that one just doesn't work?
Too Fast, Too Furious. It's a Fast and the Furious movie. That's the problem. Plus, it's one that was early in the franchise before they kind of decided to get interesting for 5 minutes. I've never been able to finish it. I've seen clips, and I just can't do it. It's just awful. There's nothing redeeming in it. And I just can't sit through it.
Yeah, you know, I would have to say that even as bad as that one is in terms, or as disappointing as it can be, I will say that I think Ebert has some points that Singleton managed to make a basically brain-dead movie that has moments of interest. That was not, however, the case with Abduction, which really fucking sucks. And I think Carl's going to agree with me. Would you?
Yeah, I would agree. And I've got something going on with my computer, so I don't know what's going on right now. But, yeah.
Can I be honest? I haven't even bothered to watch Abduction, so I couldn't even speak to that one.
Oh, save yourself then, man. Please, don't do it. Don't do it. Save your brain cells. Save the 90 minutes. No. Do it for your kids, man. Do it for your children.
No, seriously, Abduction is an absolute disaster. I got to say, Too Fast, Too Furious is not a great film, but it ain't Abduction, and I actually kind of like it, sort of like a, I hate to say this, but a guilty pleasure.
Yeah,
it's,
and I don't
okay.
really like
and,
that, sir, but
well,
I get what you're saying.
Be aware, I fucking love Vin Diesel, okay, so... He makes anything better for me, so there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Excuse me. And now we'll get to the other fun part, and that is, what are his three best works? And Carl, we're gonna start with you, but we're gonna do this the way that we always do this, where we start with number three, we go to number two, and then we finish with number one, and we do it in order. So we're going to start with you, Carl. So what is your
pick
number
for number three?
Three. Yep.
Pick for number three. Give me a moment here. I'm going to go with Rosewood.
Rosewood.
I really like Rosewood. It has a lot to say. It's well done. Don Cheadle and Bing Rames are just fantastic, but everybody in there is really good. The historical significance of it, I think, is what really brings me to that film. Because
I think it's a film that makes the point that hatred and intolerance and bigotry are taught.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
That lies kill
mm-hmm.
in a way that some people may think is heavy-handed, but I think is made very bluntly and very matter-of-factly, and it's a movie that's going to piss a lot of people off because it contains truths they don't want to face.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I think that the film is really important. And again, the historical significance of it, and that it's really focusing on something that happened that we can reflect on. I think it's a magnificent film. And I think it's a really good one.
Yeah, no.
So
it's,
there you
it's
go.
A,
that's
a,
my third pick.
It's a great movie. So, Aaron, what is your number three?
Higher Learning. Absolutely.
Ooh.
Floored me. It is a tour de force directional film. He hit some wrong notes. This is not a perfect film. It's a little messy at times. It's very heavy-handed at times. But man, oh man, is it high octane, and does it make some incredible observations that seem more eerily relevant now than maybe they did in 1995. I wonder if he had made it now, if people would think it was too heavy-handed, whereas at that point they thought that it was just kind of over the top. Higher Learning.
Yeah, no, Higher Learning is a great movie. My number three is Baby Boy, which I'm going to say when I first saw it, you know, parts of it annoyed me. Maybe because I was still a younger guy when I saw it. Even though I realized the main character was a bit of an immature jerk, I still felt that, you know, the Ving Rhames character was a bit of an asshole. But, you know, as I got away from the movie, and not long after I got away from the movie, I started to ponder it. And over the years, I thought back to that movie, and I said, man, that guy was right. He went about it in a bit of a wrong way, but that guy was an asshole to that man. And when I revisited it recently, you know, everything that I had thought of over the years on that movie, because I hadn't seen it since, turned out that, yeah, you know, it's a film that I think really has to sit with you. And it's a film that has a lot to say. And it's a film that you have to be ready to take in what it's going to say, because it is about growing up. It really is about growing up and not allowing yourself to remain a child, not allowing yourself to remain taken care of just because you're expecting someone to take care of you. Find somebody that you can love with, but don't ever demand that they care for you. They can care about you, but don't expect them to model you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my number three. So, Carl, what is your number two?
Okay, be prepared to be surprised, and perhaps you want to, like, strap in on this one. Shaft is my number two.
Oh, that's a fun one. That's a fun one.
And there's a lot of reasons for this, okay? It hit me, you know, I love 70s films. I grew up on Blaxploitation. I grew up on Shaft. I saw all three on HBO. I love Richard Roundtree, and then he fucking shows up. Okay, that was one of the most joyous things I have ever experienced in a theater, because it's the only film of his that I saw in a theater. And Samuel Jackson just had a blast. And, I mean, look at that cast.
It's my duty to please that booty. And he delivered that line, which nobody else could have delivered without making you go, oh, God. And yet you roll with it.
Yeah, but, I mean, look at this cast. Christian Bale, Jeffrey Wright, Buster Rhymes, Dan fucking Hedaya, Toni Collette. You know, Joseph Summer, for crying out fucking loud. I mean, I was just in absolute Glenn Sigbent, Pat Hingle. It's like these are people I grew up with in the 70s as character actors. You know, and Lynn Sigbent, you know, it's just like, oh, there's Carmen Sandiego. I had a blast with this movie, and I know a lot of people thought it wasn't nearly as good as the original. I think it is. I just don't think it's as iconic, because everyone looks back at the original, and that's the blaxploitation film. So this one, I thought, did a really good job, and I had a blast, and I enjoyed myself beyond belief. So there you go. That's my number two.
What is your number two, Aaron?
My number two is Baby Boy. The transformation of the Ving Rhames character from foil to the speaker of common sense that happens. And the way that Singleton allows us to see him as the foil to Tyrese Gibson's character for the entire film, and then in the last 10 minutes just totally pulls the rug out. And wait, he was right the whole time.
Yep.
It's one of the most masterful pieces of filmmaking I've ever seen.
It's wonderful.
Also, just how bold is Singleton to make this film? This is black on black criticism, the way that Chirac is, or at least the way that Chirac wants to be.
I like Chirac. I think it's a better film than a lot of people do.
I think it's good. I think it's good. I think that it's a little too messy at times. But, man, Baby Boy comes in hard. It's a really nice, what we'll call a spiritual sequel to Boys. And then the way that he fakes you with the fake tragic ending and then gives you what should be a really cheesy happy ending, but turns out to just be nice. It works. It shouldn't, but it does. And it's also the film where he really kind of pushes the boundaries of what a mainstream audience might tolerate as far as surrealism and playing with timelines and stuff. And it's just wonderful.
Well, you know, the opening where he explains some of the terminology,
mm-hmm.
that and it's done in such a way that you think it's representative of which it is, but then you realize that it's also you watching an abortion. it's like, oh shit. it's a hell of an opening and a hell of a film.
Mm-hmm.
My number two is Rosewood. Like I said, I saw it in the theater, and it is just, you know, it's a film that if it wasn't for Boys in the Hood, this would easily be his best for me. And I love Baby Boy, but this film is just, it has sat with me ever since I saw it. And that was, God, what was it, January of 97 when I saw it. So, you know, 26 years ago. It's been a long time. Great film.
Mm-hmm.
So, Carl, what is your number one?
Well, let's put it this way. Why don't we all say it at once?
I was just about to say. One, two,
Boys
three.
In the Hood.
Boys in the Hood.
Boys in the Hood.
Yep, It's got to be. It's got to be Boys in the Hood. And why not? I mean, what a movie. But, Carl, you go first with your statements on it, and then we'll continue.
So about 3 years ago, Stephen Ronkiel, my former partner, said, we're doing a commentary watch on Boys in the Hood. And I said, oh, okay. I'd seen it, okay, fine, we'll do it. Then I did it, and I did my research. And that's when I went, holy shit, this is good. And then as soon as we were done with the commentary watch, I went and watched it again. And it's funny. I think in a lot of ways, sometimes with an inundation of black films like there were in the 90s and you know, this sense of we're going to be, you know, socially conscious and so on and so forth, you get sort of like jaded. And then I watched it again, and it's like it deserves every bit of praise that it gets.
Well,
and let me tell you something. Let me finish. As far as a film debut, I'm not saying it's as good as Citizen Kane, but it's goddamn close.
It's
when
one
you
of
talk
the
about
great
debuts,
it's an amazing debut.
Seriously. I'm just enamored of it. And ever since I did that commentary watch with Steven, I was just blown away. And it definitely has taken Singleton back up for me, and I have watched some of the films that I've missed. So there you go. But, yeah, it's got to be Boys in the Hood, period.
Well, you know, you were talking about how it was, you know, something you said there, Carl, reminded me. My wife had never seen the film until about 2 years ago, and I found out she hadn't seen it. And I was like, okay, we're fucking watching this. And my wife loves movies, but she also has a tendency when she's at home, not when she goes to the theater. When she goes to the theater, she sits and she watches the whole movie. But when she's at home, she has a tendency almost every time, about halfway through a movie, to need to get up for about 5 minutes, go do something, and come back and finish it. This is one of the rare movies where she sat there. I think if I'd farted, she would have said, what are you doing? You're distracting me. She was totally enraptured from start to finish. And when it was over, because I think it runs, about an hour and 45, hour and 50,
yeah.
She couldn't believe that it was over. And, you know, I think that's a sign of a great movie, when a movie runs not a long time, but a decent time, and it feels like it's just starting and then it's done. But no, it's a movie I've seen a bunch of times, and I always find something new in it every single time. Some little moment, some detail that I'd missed or forgotten, or that means something else to me now. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful movie. And to your point, Carl, about it being one of the great debuts, yeah, I would say it's probably one of my top five, and if not my top five, definitely my top eight film debuts of all time in terms of a writer-director. I hold that film in very high regards.
Yeah.
Singleton came out of the gates just, you know, absolutely on fire.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So, Aaron, your thoughts?
It's a miracle of a film. He was nominated for the Oscar at 24. He shot this movie when he was 22 years old. He wrote it in college on his spare time. Like,
the same college he shot Higher Learning at.
What? Like, going back to Citizen Kane, I always kind of joke that John Singleton, the black Orson Welles, in that he made a perfect first film and then struggled his whole career to match it. And that's not to say that he didn't make other great films. Both men did. But
yeah.
just the bar he set for himself was so high that it, you almost feel bad for him. Like, how could he make another film this good? Like, it's almost a perfect film. It may be a perfect film. It's just monumental. And yet Lawrence Fishburne, who'd been around, his debut was Apocalypse Now, I believe.
Yes.
So yeah. he'd been around for about a decade, on and off, doing supporting work, cameo work. This is really where he kicks it into high gear.
Oh, yeah.
He's amazing. Cuba Gooding is amazing. This is Ice Cube's and Regina King's film debuts. Imagine being a person who discovered Regina King, who is an American treasure. thank you, I guess. That's all you need to know. Even if the movie was horrible, it gave us Regina King and Cuba Gooding and Larry Fishburne, Lawrence Fishburne, because I can't remember which way he's actually credited in this film.
Yeah.
And that that record, that Oscar record, will never be broken. No one will ever be the youngest director ever again. He was
like
also
that.
The first black filmmaker to be nominated for Best Director. And to break that ceiling, and granted, it took another almost 20 years to have the second one, which is tragic in and of itself. But, wow.
Yeah, no, that definitely says it all. But now I'll go back to you, Aaron, for this next question, and it's who is his most important collaborator for you?
Bruce Cannon was the editor on every film he made except for Shaft. You don't get more important than that. He edited every film he made, from Boys in the Hood through Abduction, blah, with the exception of Shaft. That's it.
Yeah. And Carl, what would your choice be? I would have to agree. It's like choosing Boys in the Hood. We're all in agreement here.
Yep, agreed.
And now, Carl, for you,
okay.
Where do you think he fits with other African American directors?
Okay, I am prejudiced, okay,
yes.
and I look back to the 70s.
Okay, everybody, grab your favorite drink. Carl's about to mention this. Oh, see, he already did it in the 70s. There we go.
Okay, but I look at Gordon Parks. I look at Melvin Van Peebles. You can go back to Oscar Michaud.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many, and Charles Burnett is someone else I think that's very, very important to Killer Sheep. And I'm not saying that he's not important, but even some of the 90s directors, I personally like better. Bill Duke and Deep Cover. Deep Cover is one of the greatest fucking films that came out of the 90s, period.
Okay. Deep Cover is a great fucking movie. Still some of Lawrence Fishburne's best work.
You know, Hoodlum and the things that he did, I'm more attuned to him. Carl Franklin, Devil in a Blue Dress, I think is a great film in what he's done. I don't know. Singleton, as much as I really appreciate him, I didn't connect with him more, as much as these other ones I'm mentioning. So for me, he's sort of middle in the pack or just above the middle in the pack. But that's me. I think if you look at it more objectively, you're going to put him above Bill Duke. You're going to put him above Carl Franklin. But for me, it's the other way around, just because I enjoy their films better. That's me.
Hmm. Yeah. And it is subjective. So, Aaron, what about your views on this?
As far as an historical figure, he has to be in the pantheon. Like we just said, at 24 years old, he became the first black filmmaker to receive a Best Director nomination. He broke a very, very long trend of white dudes competing with other white dudes, because keep in mind there'd only been one woman to be nominated by that point, still two. So, historically, he is very important. I tend to agree with Carl that as far as, there are other filmmakers I like more. There are other filmmakers that I think maybe have a little more to say, or the way they're saying it just jives with me a little better. But he's wonderful. It's hard to put in a box, because he's so himself without really having I don't know if I could call him an auteur, despite the fact that he really is, but I don't see a distinct signature that you see with someone like Spike Lee or Steve McQueen, Barry Jenkins. Those guys they make their marks on their films. Singleton was a little more workmanlike, and that's fine. That's great, especially with how great he was. It just makes it a little harder to judge him against these other guys. And women. Lemons, man, she came out of the gate swinging, too, with Yves Bayou. Gina Price Blythewood came out of the gates. She came out in 2000, though, not 90s. And, of course, Spike came out in the 80s. But, great decade for black filmmaking. I think he works better as part of the movement than he does as maybe a figurehead, despite his place in history.
Mm-hmm. I tend to agree with both of you on this. I have a lot of respect for him, and I love a lot of his movies, but there are directors and works that I love more. You really go to something those top three or four films of his, and you could put those really with anybody. It's outside of that top three or four that he becomes a little softer as far as where he belongs in terms of, And I hesitate to use the term rankings, but where I think he's going to end up in terms of his not his legacy, but where we end up thinking of him and that. But, you know, his importance, I don't think can be denied. So now that's just about it. I mean, we you know, there's a few of his films we haven't mentioned, like, you know, Four Brothers, which was a fun little movie. Poetic Justice, which isn't a bad movie, but I just it left me a little cold. But I get what it's going for.
I really like the way he played with the rom-com conventions. It just I don't think ever truly comes together the way it needed to.
Yeah.
Agreed.
But that said, I'm going to turn the show over briefly to Carl to do housekeeping. So, Carl, what is coming up on Deviant Legion?
Okay, just a moment, because I had a slight difficulty with my computer, and I'm back here, and I can tell you what's going on. So here we are with housekeeping. Okay, so tomorrow, Rachel and I are going to be doing another summer commentary watch, and we're going to do one of Rachel's favorite films, and we're doing Lake Placid. And, of course, that's the wonderful film with Betty White feeding a cow to an alligator. So there you go. You want to join us for that and maybe have some alligator burgers or something like that. That would be a good thing. Then on Sunday, we have Rock the Sound Radio with PC, and he's doing his co-host Randy Gorley is going to be with him, and they're doing a whole series of songs with apostrophes in the title, and they're calling it Apostrophes Matter. And I am going to be leaving on Monday for a quick vacation, and I will be back on Thursday. So Friday, a week from today, we are going to have a podcast in memoriam for Paul Rubens, otherwise known as Pee Wee Herman. And Rachel and I and Vicki will be on, along with our special guest, Keenan Walker. Keenan Walker was very good friends with Pee Wee Herman and appeared with him a number of times. He is the Duckmaster at the Peabody Hotel. He's also an actor, does a lot of independent films. He has a lot to say, and we may have another special guest on. We're working on that right now. But that's going to be on Friday, the 11th. And then I think Saturday we may be doing some things, and we have some things coming up the week after that I am setting up right now. So that's what we're doing so far within the week.
Hmm. Yep. Now, we may be doing some stuff here next week. We may do the very first commentary watch next week. It depends, of course, unfortunately, on everybody's schedules, but stay tuned. We'll make some postings. If so, it'll be a commentary watch on one or two episodes of an all-time great sitcom. Let's leave it at that. If we end up doing it, if everybody's schedules work out this week, we'll probably do that. While you're off, Carl, if we can. But for
that would be a wonderful thing to do for our listeners.
But for absolute sure, we will be back here on Cathode Ray Mission in 2 weeks on August 18th for a look at Top of the Lake and Top of the Lake China Girl, which will, of course, complete our look at the works of Jane Campion. A now twice delayed episode, but them's the breaks, folks, as they say. And 2 weeks after that, so jumping to almost a month away, we have a look at the works of Peter Watkins, a most unusual director, and we'll get into that as we get closer, but he's a British director, and he does typically very long, long works. A 2-3 hours? Yeah, that's just the trailer, folks. I mean, I guess he does have some films that are more typical run times, and those are actually, honestly, I think his best works. But really, really interesting director. And we'll be back for that. We may end up having one other guest. It depends on if his schedule allows. But that's what's coming up over the next month here on Cathode Ray Mission. So, you know, I think we're pretty much done with Singleton. We'll probably circle back to him later just to make sure we're covered. But we lost somebody today in the world of acting. Mark Margolis, who is probably now best known for playing Hector Salamanca on Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, passed away at the age of 83. Long career, lots of roles, one of the last of a certain breed of character actor. And, you know, he's done a lot of roles, and I'm not saying this is his best work, but he has one of the most memorable scenes in any film of the 2000s, and that's his role as Mr. Rabinowitz in Requiem for a Dream, where the character of Harry and his friend, having stolen Harry's mother's TV, apparently not for the first time, deliver it to Mr. Rabinowitz, played by Margolis, who says, "What the fuck? The table too? You know what you are, son? You're a goneth. Your mother needs you like a moose needs a hat rack." And the way he delivers the line, you'll never forget it. It is perfect. It is absolutely perfect. But I, you know, we can talk a little bit about him. I'm sure we'll have a, you know, you and I and a few others will do a show on Margolis sometime after the Rubens tribute.
Oh,
but,
well, I definitely want to do a show on this actor. No question. I love this man.
But yeah, I'll let you have a minute or two, and then we'll talk to Aaron about his thoughts. So, Carl, go with yours.
Okay, so I go back to this guy actually in 1972. Okay, and many people may not know this, but Mark Margolis, he made his feature film debut in a porno film. Now, luckily, he was not disrobed and did not have a sex scene, but he was in the opening of Misty Beethoven, which was directed by Riley Metzger, one of the greatest sexploitation directors. But where I got to know him was The Equalizer, and he played Jimmy, and you love this character. He's in like about 15 or 16 episodes as one of the posse that McCall uses. He's always complaining about his wife, and he's in the midst of a divorce, and like he's just so he's like Eeyore in Winnie the Pooh. You know, he's the human Eeyore of this, and he's just wonderful.
Oh, damn, my shoes won't tie. I'm going to jump off this fire escape.
Exactly.
Ah, shit, I can't get this stain out of my suit. Where's my gun?
Yeah,
because he was always trying to kill himself over some petty shit.
Yeah, but this is a guy that did so much great work. You know, and you would see him in so many things. But, you know, one of the things, too, is he made another really big important film, Scarface, which I do not like Scarface, the Al Pacino film. I despise it. But he is by far the best thing in it. He's his bodyguard. But he was in so many of Aronofsky's films, too. Darren Aronofsky loved him. And probably best known for the role of the older mathematician in Pi.
Yeah.
You know, but he was in Gone, Baby, Gone. He, you know, just, and so many just quick little cameos. You know, but whenever you saw him, you loved him. And let's not forget Ace Ventura either. I mean, he did so many different types of roles, too. Usually, you know, you think of him as a gangster, you know, or that sort of thing. But he was able to do comedy. He was able to do all sorts of things. And every time I saw him, I just was happy. He made me happy. So that's all I've got to say right now about Mark Margolis.
So, Aaron, what are your thoughts?
He was Kojak, right?
You know, he might have had a spot on Kojak.
Oh, I can verify that momentarily. Give me a moment.
He's kind of like the ultimate that guy, right? Like he's just in freaking everything. And he was always good. Like not always great, not always better than he had to be, but he was never bad, that's for sure. And yeah, at this point I'm thinking probably most of us know him for Breaking Bad and Santa Monica. Which was a great role for whatever that's worth. But, yeah, he's great.
By the way, he was in Kojak for one episode. Yes,
right.
He was.
All right.
Yep.
He's also
no,
in Short Eyes, too, and Going in Style and Dressed to Kill. Now,
yeah,
small role.
Thank you so much.
I mean, incredible.
Really, he really was. He really was. But you know, we'll save this for the Margolis show, and we'll finish up the Singleton show. And I'll start with you, Carl. Is there anything about Singleton that we haven't said yet that you'd like to bring up before we get going?
To be honest, no. I think we covered it pretty well. I do think he has a special place in history because of Boys in the Hood and
yeah.
What transpired, that he was 24 and he was black and he was nominated. I think it is always going to be a very, very special thing in history and one of the greatest debuts in film history. Period. No question.
Yeah.
So that's all I have to say.
Yeah. And you, Aaron, anything you want to bring up before we go?
Totally agree on all fronts. If he'd never made another decent movie, Boys in the Hood would still make him a legend. It's just that good.
Yeah.
It really is. And I don't think I have anything else to add. Just make sure you at least see that one.
Yeah, I honestly, it should be taught in every modern American film class that goes more than, say, six or eight films should probably consider having it. It's honestly that important. It really, really is, you know. It's just, I mean, you know, there was, I'll say it, it's one of those turning points. There really wasn't an urban cinema of that sort. It existed, but it changed urban cinema. It's where urban cinema, I don't want to say grew up, but became what it is now. It showed that there was something more, that there were other dimensions that could be explored, that it wasn't just all exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very commendable. You know, so in a way there was cinema before and after, you know, they talk about before Kane and after Kane. You could just as easily say there was cinema before and after Boys in the Hood. Mm-hmm. It is one of those turning points. It really is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want to thank everyone for coming in, as always, and I want to thank everybody out there for listening, as always. It truly is appreciated. And with that, we will close this out. So on the count of three, we will say good night. So one, two, three, good night, folks.
Good night. Don't let the bed bugs bite.